Welcome to More to Come, PW Comics World's weekly podcast about comics and graphic novel news. I'm Heidi McDonald, the editor-in-chief of The Beat at comicsbeat.com. And don't forget, you can find us on all social media at PW Comics World. And don't forget to leave us a note or a rating because we love to hear from our listeners. But we also love to hear from our guest today, Jonah Newman. Jonah, welcome.
Thank you, Heidi. I have been a fan of the More to Come podcast for years, listen to almost every episode, so it's super thrilling to finally be on the podcast.
Oh my God. Well, the pleasure is all ours. So Jonah is, your day job is as associate editor at Scholastic, correct?
Yep.
But you have a brand new graphic novel out of left field, which combines queer themes, baseball, teen drama, high school. It's got it all, really. It is action packed.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So Jonah, I've known you for a while, and I think we probably bonded a little bit over both being baseball fans, and then you mentioned you were doing this graphic novel that had baseball as part of its themes. So tell us the origin of Out of Left Field, because I have a feeling it is a long journey. You've worked on it for 6 years, so how did it begin?
I think that I wanted to tell the story of my high school experience, especially connected to baseball, almost from the minute I stopped living it. I remember writing a short story in a fiction class in college that was kind of based on that. And, you know, I put the idea aside for a few years while I was working on other things, but then I came back to it in 2018 and I started to write it. And at first it was a memoir, you know, it was nonfiction. But as the story evolved and as I got some really good editorial feedback, I kind of pushed it further and further in the direction of fiction until I could no longer really call it a memoir. And I became much more concerned with capturing the truthful emotions of what I experienced, you know, more so than, I guess, the details of the plot. So the result is Out of Left Field. And, you know, because I do the writing and the art, it's super, super time consuming. I mean, anyone who works on comics or who reads comics in an informed way knows how time consuming it is. I wrote the whole script, and then, penciled it all on paper and then inked it digitally. And luckily, my publisher, has a colorist on staff who I worked with. So that was fantastic. And she did a great job. And of course, it saved me a lot of time as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's back up just a little bit about how you did you always want to be a cartoonist? Was this always like the medium that you wanted to tell your stories in?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I have loved writing and drawing ever since I was a little kid. But I mean, even just mentioning the fact that I wrote, you know, a short story in college, there was a time when I wanted to be a prose writer. Also in college, actually weirdly in a Roman history class, I got back into making comics after having not done it for many years. And I adapted Plutarch's Life of Caesar into a comic. So that was a lot of fun. And it kind of like rekindled that passion for making comics that I had made comics in middle school a lot, like, you know, single strip gag comics, basically. But I had not really done it seriously in any way. So then in college, I did this comics project and I got back into it and I started to work on a graphic novel that I ended up publishing as a web comic. And as I worked on that and, you know, got better at writing and better at drawing through that process, and I really started to embrace comics as my medium of choice. And this was coinciding with my reading a lot more graphic novels and becoming more interested in graphic novel publishing, and then eventually getting a job in graphic novel publishing at Scholastic. So at this point, it's very hard for me to imagine working in any other medium. I feel like I'm so specialized in the unique, like, visual storytelling way that comics works. I think I would be probably a pretty terrible prose writer at this point, and likewise maybe a pretty terrible illustrator. But if you combine those things and make it comics, that's something I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is, I mean, the story flows really well. And yeah, I really enjoyed reading it. So it was a really good story. And, you know, just because of the characterization, but I will say it is kind of funny. Now in the book, you are a ninth grader when it starts, and you're not sure that you're gay, and you see a cute boy who's on the baseball team, so you decide to try out for the baseball team. And so that's a little bit like you're doing comics. It's kind of like, so you kind of have this idea of like, oh, I'm going to do this thing that I don't really know how to do, but turns out I do know how to do it.
Yeah, that's a big part of the early arc of this book is, you know, embracing who you are and accepting who you are is one thing, but first you have to like figure out who you are. Yeah. And so early on in the book, you know, I think Jonah has this crush on this boy that he doesn't even fully realize or understand is a crush right away. And just kind of feels like, oh, I want to be like him, or I want to be friends with him. I want to be in that cool group, which is the baseball team. And it's only throughout sort of trials and tribulations and mistakes and false starts that he learns, you know, okay, this is a crush, and maybe this means that I'm gay, and, you know, maybe at some point I can put a label on it and then finally embrace it. You know, and I think that was fairly similar to my arc in reality in middle school and high school, where I knew I had crushes on boys, but I probably wouldn't have considered myself gay until several years kind of into that process.
But did you join the baseball team because this boy that you had a crush on was on the team?
I mean, it's a bit of an oversimplification.
Okay.
That's one of the fictionalizations that is in this story. I got into baseball in part because my little brother had started to play Little mm-hmm. League. But also, all of the kids in my class were this would have been eighth grade in my real life. They were playing the final season of Little League, which was called senior minors, which is kind of a strange oxymoronic term. But anyway, all of the kids in my middle school class were playing senior minors, and they were so cool, you know, and I just wanted to be cool. And I may or may not have had crushes on some of them, but it kind of came from this desire for social acceptance as well,
yeah.
Which I think is in the book. It's kind of a mm-hmm. confusing mixture of, you know, burgeoning sexuality and just more typical high school stuff about acceptance and you know, trying
Well, you do, so wait, before I go any further, I have to ask you this. So even though you say you did fictionalize your story, the main character is still named Jonah Newman.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
So why did you do that? So, because that is just going to make everybody assume every single thing in the book actually happened.
I know. And I struggled with that, honestly, because there are a lot of graphic novels that are kind of, you know, that are semi-autobiographical, where mm-hmm. the protagonist is pretty clearly based on the creator, but has a different name. And I guess I just thought that it was so clearly me, like, why change
mm-hmm.
it?
I
don't know. I'm still not 100% necessarily behind that choice, but If I had changed more aspects of that protagonist to be further from me, I might have changed the name. But in the end, that's just what I did. And again, for me, it was all about kind of trying to encapsulate the emotional truth and convey that to the reader, because real life is so complicated and it's so hard to distill it into a book that actually makes sense and is entertaining and that people can connect to. So that was really the biggest goal with this book, was to capture that and convey that to the reader in a way that hopefully people would find relatable.
Well, I feel like you really did. I mean, I am not gay, but I definitely, like, you made Jonah's journey. I mean, anyone who can't relate to this story, you know, I'm sorry for them. Because... But you also have the journey of a kind of subculture, jocks versus nerds. You're like the Jonah in the book is a big old nerd watching the Rings of the Lords, and a lot of Tolkien references in there, which I'm a big nerd, so that I definitely appreciated. But yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this actually when we've run into each other that the, you know, like jocks versus nerds kind of dichotomy, it's still strong. It's one that hasn't really gone away.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, that it's another very truthful part of my experience. I mean, I was and am still a big history buff. You know, I love Star Wars. I love Lord of the Rings, which of course I fictionalized in this story in a satirical way, that I thought was fun. And those interests felt very incompatible at one time with my interest in baseball and my desire to be, you know, a baseball player and an athlete. Now, of course, I've realized that it's not incompatible, and, you know, I can be gay and a history nerd and into Star Wars and into baseball all at the same time. And it actually works together quite well. But, you know, in high school, that it was hard to see how those things could connect.
And you certainly, Jonah in the story has a lot of conflicts with his teammates who do act like boorish jerks. But, you know, the joke's on them because baseball is the nerdiest sport by far, I think. Anyway, I think that's one of the reasons why I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm actually a huge fantasy baseball nut. At the time of this recording, I am frantically preparing for my fantasy baseball draft this upcoming weekend, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, wow, you're preparing the whole week for your fantasy. Wow, I had one rotisserie baseball, but
I've been preparing all year. I've been listening to podcasts. I've been looking at baseball. Yeah, my league mates stand no chance. But I love how nerdy it is. I love how, like, you can deep dive into the data, and a lot of the fantasy baseball content I consume is very kind of cerebral. And that's, of course, how major league front offices are thinking now. You know, everyone knows the book and or film Moneyball, and that was kind of the time when the nerds took over baseball, and now they've like fully taken over baseball. And I think that's pretty cool. But at the same time, there's still a lot of homophobia in the sport. And
yes,
there is not a major league baseball player who's actively playing who has come out as gay, bisexual, anything other than, you know, a cis straight guy. And there's just no way that they aren't out there. It's just they're hiding because they don't feel comfortable. And even in the year 2024, you know, even when nerd culture has become a lot more normalized, and even when there's a lot more acceptance of LGBTQ people in many of other areas of our lives and society, you know, in the highest echelons of professional sports, I think there's still really pervasive homophobia. So hopefully this book will help to change that to some degree, at least convince some teenager who plays baseball on a kind of macho, toxic, masculine sort of environment that they can be themselves, and maybe that will trickle up eventually to the major leagues.
Right. I thought that was really just a really wonderful part of this book, actually, was just, you know, Jonah's journey to understand himself, like you say. It was, you know, understanding what these feelings are and his relationship with girls. He has a very close female friend in school, and what his, you know, feelings for her are, and then dealing with the rejection by his teammates, and over his gradual realization and, you know, identifying as gay and having a gay relationship with another boy, which is disheartening. I mean, you know, we do have these fantasy Check Please, for instance. Okay. And I mean, in manga, there, you cannot, you know, throw a baseball without hitting some kind of queer sports story. So they're incredibly popular actually around the world.
Yeah, and Heartstopper is an extraordinarily popular graphic novel series and TV show, but it's quite utopian, in my opinion. I mean, look, I was in high school 10, 15 years ago, and things have changed a lot since then, but I also don't, like, I don't believe that. And it's just not true that gay and queer kids are just having a great time and are accepted. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of light bullying and a little bit of light conflict, but for the most part, they have, you know, wonderful accepting relationships and friends. And it's great when that happens. But I do think that the sort of the positive tone of Heartstopper, as much as I love it, it belies a lot of the darker stuff that's happening. And especially, I think, in the world of male sports. Because the people that I played baseball with in high school, if you'd asked them, are you in favor of gay marriage? You know, this would have been a few years before gay marriage was legalized nationwide. They would have said yes. You know, they were like progressive. They voted for Obama. And yet, when we went between the lines on the baseball field, it was all of these kind of anti-gay jokes and misogyny and heteronormativity and just very kind of bro-y, I guess, like caveman sort of stuff. So it was kind of amazing to me, and I think that dynamic is probably still in place in a lot of boys and men's sports teams even now.
So, I mean, it's funny because I did ask Ngozi Ikazu one time, the creator of Check Please. I did a panel with her and I asked her afterwards. I said, but don't you, I said, you know, do you, I kind of said what you were expressing, what you just said. And I was just like, you know, don't you think that, I mean, it's really amazing that you don't portray the team as having issues with this gay relationship, and you know that you saw them as so accepting. And she said something that was so thought-provoking to me. That was just, you know, but why should we expect that? You know, why shouldn't we tell a story that expects better behavior, better tolerance? And I was like, you know, we do. I think we need both. I think we need to have the stories that are, you know, kind of utopian in a way, and stories like yours that show it's. It wasn't, you know, it's not that rough. So could I ask you, did you know, what was your real life experience on the team? Did they know that you were gay and what happened?
No, they never knew that I was gay. The plot line in the book of the team finding out that Jonah is in a relationship with another boy didn't happen. I did have a secret relationship with a boy in high school, but no one ever found out about it. And it was not, you know, extreme homophobic slurs 24/7. You know, it was not direct attacks. It wasn't like threats of actual violence, anything as extreme as that. But it was kind of a low constant ebb and a sense of like, it is not okay to be gay on this team. Or like, there is an expectation that you are straight and that you are interested in girls and that we can talk about that in crude terms with each other because, you know, we're guys on this team. And it was, I think in almost like a bonding sort of way. It was like I strongly remember when I was a freshman, and this was a story I tried to work into the book at one point. It didn't end up making it in, but one of the first practices when I was a freshman, the seniors asked all of the freshman boys, who's the hottest girl in the freshman class? Who's the hottest girl in school? And what's your favorite porn site? And me, as a little 15-year-old, having like without good answers to these questions at all, you know, I just remember completely floundering and you know, giving answers that made them laugh because I had no idea what I was talking about, you know. And so that's that sort of thing where they weren't explicitly saying, you know, we hate gay people. But they were creating an environment where it was very difficult to imagine being open about that.
And you know, like you say, I don't think there's ever has there been I think that there was a football player who was out and still playing on the field, but he retired right afterwards. So there was a basketball player. They seem to come out just before they retire for very understandable reasons.
Yeah, so, it's true.
Yeah. And, you know, not to be too, I hate to bring this up, but it does seem germane since we're talking about this. You know, so the book is published by Andrews McMeel, which is, you know, awesome. I know they have, kind of been doing graphic novels on and off. So, you know, let's face it, a lot of books with queer themes are being banned, like here in New York, outside of Staten Island school, they just found piles of books, not only gay themed books, but just books about, black people, books about famous Americans who happen to be black. So obviously there is a huge book banning going on right now. And look, you know, out of left field is, you know, are you prepared for it to possibly be targeted?
Yeah, it's always been something that's on my mind. I mean, it's got a rainbow on the cover, right? Like it's not hiding what it is in any way. Yeah, it's something I am prepared for, or something that I expect, I guess, to some degree. I don't know if I can be prepared for it, because it's a horrible thing to happen to any creator in any book, of course. But it also raises the profile of that book in a way that may benefit sales numbers. So I don't know. It's like, I'm not even necessarily, I guess it's kind of like any publicity is good publicity situation. But at the same time, I think it's naive for me to think that it wouldn't be a horribly upsetting experience, especially depending on the extent of the banning and the vitriol of the messages that I might get. I know that, you know, people like Maya Kobabe and Molly Ostertag have had intense and upsetting experiences with their books getting banned, while the banning has raised their profile.
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate that you even have to think about this, but such is the crappy world we live in. So you do work as an associate editor at Scholastic. Now, you don't work directly for Scholastic Graphics. Is that correct?
I do, actually. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I sort of dabble in several different imprints. I also work on picture books a little bit, but the vast majority of the work that I do is in graphics, and I'm part of the graphics core team.
Because I think when you were hired, I asked you, and you said you weren't necessarily under graphics, so I don't know if that changed, right?
Yeah, that's true. I kind of evolved over time, and I've just been able, luckily, to do more and more graphic novels over time. And it started with getting brought on to help with Dave Pilkey Publishing, my boss.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. my boss, Ken Geist, who I was hired to help him with picture books. And at the time, he was the head of the entire 0-8 publishing program. So I was kind of the department assistant, as well as Ken's assistant. But Ken also edits Dave Pilkey. So Ken brought me on to help with that, which has just been incredible, just transformative for my career and something I've really, really enjoyed because, you know, Dave Pilkey is one of the nicest, most generous, most humble creators there is. I mean, of course, one of the most successful, but you really could not meet a nicer man, and someone more lovely to work with.
That's so wonderful to hear. I mean, obviously, Dave Pilkey, I mean, he's not even just the most, you know, successful author. He's a cartoonist. He's like one of the two or three most successful authors in America or in the English language right now. So, I mean, of course, I've got to ask you, I mean, what's it like working with Dave Pilkey? Aside from him being so nice, I mean, does he require any editing? You say, yeah, you know, I think that Dog Man would do this, Dave. He's a character. Yeah, come on.
No, I mean, We do, Ken and I do send, you know, feedback to Dave and suggestions to Dave from time to time. But for the most part, he does his thing. I mean, he's so professional and experienced and fast, honestly. Like, he draws 500 pages of comics a year. I mean, he puts out 2 graphic novels a year, and he is doing 100% of that himself, other than the coloring. All of the stuff in the Cat Kid Comic Club books, which is a spin-off series from Dogman that started to publish in 2020. There's original art in all kinds of different media in those books. There's models that Dave builds. There's photography that he does. You know, painting, paper cuts, like all of that stuff. He does all of that himself and draws every single line of every single panel of his books. So it's just, it's really amazing, his workload. And yeah, essentially he turns in pages and we look at them, we send them to the colorist, and every book is just an intense process. I mean, it's, you know, these are major books on the Scholastic list, and it is a high profile, high pressure publishing program. So it can be intense, especially when you're getting down to those printing deadlines. I really love the books and I really love Dave, and it's such a privilege to get to work on that publishing program, that it's, you know, I'm more than happy to put in that work and those intense hours.
I mean, the books are also so good. You know, I have, when I get extra copies, I pass them along to, I have a lot of young cousins that I pass them along. They love them. They start reading them and want them read over and over and over again. I mean, it's just such good storytelling, and I just also, you know, I think Dave's been imitated or aspired to, you know, he's created kind of a whole genre of comics, to be honest. But he doesn't, you know, his books aren't simplistic at all. There's so much that goes on in them. It's such depth of storytelling. It's really, it's hard to do what he does.
Yeah, it really is. It's not just his speed and his volume of output, but the way that he balances laugh out loud humor and heartfelt poignancy is really amazing. Yeah. And I think really hard to do. And, you know, because he kind of broke out with Captain Underpants, I think still has a bit of a reputation as being this like potty humor sort of author. Yeah. And I think that the people who think that have never read, you know, some of the more recent Dogman books, the Cat Kid Comic Club series, and seen the, you know, the depth of feeling, and the nuance in those books and the important messages for kids.
Yeah. Well, I think what's also amazing about Dave Pilkey's career, and I mean this, you know, to kind of bring it back to your career, as fascinating as Dave Pilkey is, but I think, now I don't know for a fact, but I mean, the Captain Underpants books were always kind of almost comics. You know, they were so heavily illustrated, but I don't think when they started that Scholastic had, you know, like you couldn't publish them as kids graphic novels, because that just genre didn't, that category didn't exist. And, you know, now, I mean, obviously, you know, Raina Telgemeier at Scholastic and, you know, the Babysitter's Club and all these, you know, Kazoo, Amulet, Bone, there's so many groundbreaking books at Scholastic. And, you know, now it's kind of safe for Dave Pilkey to be a cartoonist. And it's pretty, just amazing to see how the, you know, even when you were a kid, maybe it wasn't as obvious that being a cartoonist who made books for kids was even a career path.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And when I was getting back into comics seriously, you know, starting in college, it was an era where, you know, First, Second, and Graphics had been around doing their thing for a number of years. And other publishers were just starting to launch graphic novel imprints, Harper Alley, Random House Graphic, Little Brown Ink, you know, all of these places sprouted up in, you know, 2018 or so, 2019. Apologize if I got those exact dates wrong, but it's been a massive explosion of graphic novel imprints. And because of that, lots more agents do graphic novels now. There are a lot more cartoonists, probably, or at least, you know, cartoonists who are getting, I guess, mainstream publishing exposure than ever before. you go into a bookstore and there's just so many more graphic novels to choose from, especially graphic novels for kids.
Yeah.
So it's a really exciting time. And of course, like, you know, my story probably wouldn't have gotten published if not for those market conditions. And it's great because it's giving a lot more people a chance to publish. But at the same time, the market saturation makes it potentially harder to rise above the pack.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the market has matured now. I mean, it has become saturated. And I think we're starting to see that just, a little bit of fatigue. I mean, post-pandemic, everything's sort of up in the air. But I think it's also pretty obvious that kids like comics. I don't see any danger of the category suddenly vanishing.
Yeah, neither do I. And manga, of course, is also so big. Web comics still are so big. People are not going to stop reading comics anytime soon. That's for sure.
No, that is impossible, or making them. So, is there any books that you have coming out or just recently came out that you worked on by maybe some people who have flown under the radar some creators that you really think people should pay more attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll mention a couple of series that I edit that I think are really, really great. The first one is called The Leon Series by Jamar Nicholas.
Ah, we love Jamar here. We've had him on the show.
Yeah. Jamar is another one of those people who's just a great person, such a talented creator, but just a really, really kind and lovely human. The first book in the series, Leon the Extraordinary, came out in 2022. And the next book is called Leon Worst Friends Forever, and it's coming out this October. In fact, this week we're sending it to print. So I've been kind of scrambling to get that one done. It's always intense right towards the end, but really, really great book. A lot of fun. It has the same kind of balance of action, humor, and heartfelt emotion that the first one does. So I think people should absolutely go get that this fall. You can pre-order it now. Mm-hmm. And Jamar has a third book in the series signed up with us too that he's starting to work on. And then the second series I want to plug is The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids adaptations. Mm. So in the 90s, I think it was the early 90s when this series started, Scholastic started to publish The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids chapter books, which people may remember from, titles like Vampires Don't Wear Polka Dots and Werewolves Don't Go to Summer Camp. I edited four graphic novel adaptations of those, which the fourth one is coming out in April of this year, April 2024, and it's called Dragons Don't Cook Pizza. And I worked with a couple of really, really talented cartoonists on adapting and illustrating those. Pearl Lowe did the first two, and Angelie Rafer did books 3 and 4. And those are aimed at younger readers, age 6 to 8. So if you have, younger kids who are interested in comics or graphic novels, but they might not be quite ready for middle grade stuff or older, this is a really great series to start them on, and a lot of fun, monsters and things like that in them too.
That's great to know. I mean, again, I have a lot of very young cousins, and, I do get a lot of books at home, and I love passing them on to the kids. And, I'm always hearing like, oh, it's their favorite book now or something like that. So I'm like, yes, I'm doing my part.
Spreading the good word.
Yeah. Is there anything like, I imagine as Scholastic, you only get submissions through agents, but, and as you mentioned, there's a lot more agents who handle graphic novels, but is there anything that you're noticing just among, the young cartoonists that you're seeing or the pitches that you're seeing? It's amazing to me how, if I go to SVA, which I've done every year for like 20 years, every year when there wasn't a pandemic, that is. And, probably 20 years ago when I started going, everybody wanted to be Marvel or DC, and it was mostly boys. Of course, now it's mostly girls, and they all want to do manga. But there is a lot more who want to do kids, juvenile graphic novels as well. And is there anything that you've seen just trend-wise about the evolving creators?
I mean, manga influence is absolutely there in almost everything, just stylistically, visually. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of manga style drawing or manga influenced drawing. A lot of queer content. I mean, it almost feels to me like there are more queer graphic novels than not these days, which I think is great because, you know, we're getting a full spectrum of queer identities, being shown on the page and creators being represented as well. So I think that's great. But, you know, it's kind of like, for the same reason that I got into kids graphic novel publishing specifically, rather than, let's say, adult graphic novel publishing or, the direct market style publishing, Marvel and DC, it's just because it's like where the money is, you know? I think creators can see, oh, these books are coming out and they're being successful and they're landing on the bestseller list. And, you know, publishers, like massive publishers with a lot of resources, are investing in these books. So if I'm going to spend hours and hours of my life making comics, you know, I should make comics that ideally can sell or, you know, that I can publish. So I think there's a lot of that going on, whether consciously or not, among the artists and creators who are coming up today.
That's wild, though. I mean, you're young, so you don't remember this time. But there was a time, like in the 90s, when there was no kids' comics. And I mean, I would talk to creators and they'd be like, you know, what's your dream project? And I'd say, well, I have this great kid's story that I want to do, but I just don't know who will publish it. And there was even this organization, and now I'm going to mess up the name of it, but it was called like Kids Read Comics or something like that. And it was all these kind of creators who did like indie books that were aimed at kids. And they had to come together as kind of an advocacy group to try to tell publishers that kids would read comics. And it was, you know what, Jonah? It was a real uphill struggle. So it's again, I mean, not to be the old fart, but I am, so, you know, but just, it's just astonishing to me that we had this dark age. It's not astonishing to me that graphic novels for kids are selling super well. It's just astonishing to me that we had this dark age where people thought they couldn't sell.
Yeah, I know. And it's so cool for me personally to work with people like David Saylor and Cassandra Pelham Fulton and Phil Falco every day at my job, Scholastic, because, you know, they really were pioneers in this space.
Yeah, totally.
You know, Mark Siegel and Calista Brill at First Second. I mean, the people who kind of spearheaded this and made it into a thing and developed an entire new market space are still doing their thing and still putting out really great books for kids. So getting a chance to absorb the experience and wisdom of all of those people has been one of the greatest privileges of my job.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I'll just give a shout out to Whitney Leopard at Random House Graphics and Andrew Arnold at Harper Alley and Andrea Colvin, Little Brown. I mean, this is a really fantastic lineup of editors to be overseeing this renaissance. So it's really fantastic. So Jonah, of course, now that you've spent 6 years of your life on this book, and I will say I've known you, you know, we met before the pandemic, just before the pandemic, I think. And you were telling me about the book then, and then, you know, years go by and you're still working on the book. So I always feel a little bad for people who, you know, are taking a long time. So yeah, will you make your own comics again?
Yeah, 100%. I'm working on an idea for another YA graphic novel that is about two kids navigating college admissions madness. And this was kind of inspired a little by learning about Operation Varsity Blues, you know, which is the where celebrities essentially bribed a guy to, you know, pretend that their kids were, you know, water polo stars and things like that. And to hire someone to take standardized tests for them and really mind-blowing stuff that really happened. And when I was in high school, you know, I remember this kind of college mania happening around me as well and just the level of competition even then. And I just think it's gotten so much worse. I just read an article in New York Magazine about a guy who charges like $500,000 to rich Park Avenue parents to try to give their kids an edge in this hyper-competitive, increasingly competitive college admissions process. So I've been reading a lot about this, and it's very, very fascinating to me. I also think, like, hilarious. Like, I love the prospect of making fun of some of this stuff. As kind of scary as it is in some ways, it's rich ground for satire. And I also think it's really rich territory for the sort of coming of age story that, you know, similar to what I did in Out of Left Field, you know, kids, teenagers trying to figure out who they are and what they really want to do with their lives in the midst of all of this pressure around them. So that's what I'm working on now. It's in its early stages. It's basically a synopsis and part of a script right now. It hasn't been sold yet. Hopefully it will find a home soon. But yeah, I mean, realistically, it's probably going to be another several years before it's out there.
I was going to say, and you are going to draw this one as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I fully intend to keep writing and drawing and making comics. You know, it's just a question of balancing it with the day job and with everything else going on in life.
Yeah, wow. Well, that is a full slate of work, Jonah. So it is not, definitely, you know, it's a big lift to do both of them. So I commend you for that, and, you know, let alone do them so well. So are you a baseball fan?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah, but who do you support?
I support the San Francisco Giants.
Right, because the story, that's why I thought the story took place in the Bay Area, which is where you grew up, right? So.
Yes. So when I was a junior in high school, the Giants won the World Series in 2010, and that was the first of three World Series titles in 5 years. So that was a thrill. The team has been pretty mediocre to bad ever since then, with the exception of 2021, which feels sort of like an outlier now. But, you know, the Giants made a lot of additions this offseason. They didn't get Shohei Ohtani, which I really wanted them to get. Of course, he went to the evil empire Dodgers.
Oh, the Dodgers,
But I do like how the Giants have improved this year. I'm excited to watch them and just excited for baseball season in general. I mean, I love going to Yankees and Mets games here in New York. As I mentioned, I love fantasy baseball. I love just watching a random baseball game. You know, and that's starting up in just a couple of weeks. So it's a really great time of year.
It is fantastic. And, you know, I've said this before, you know, by the way, those three World Series winning Giants teams, that was a really great team. I mean, of course they are. They won three World Series, but what a great team that was. And they, you know, Tim Lincecum, they had some Hunter Pence. They had so many great players on there. So it was Hunter Pence, right? Or am I mixing it up?
Okay. Yeah, Hunter Pence was on, I think, two of the three championship teams. Yeah, right. Lincecum was on all three. Buster Posey was on all three.
And then there was that crazy reliever.
Yeah, Brian Wilson with the beard.
Yes. And, you know, he made these kind of bondage videos and stuff. I love relief pitchers. They're my favorite. They're always, relief pitchers are my favorites. I mean, I will say, you know, they used to be so, you know, the screwball on the team, or the nerd on the team, or the, you know, the wild one on the team, you know, and now they're a little bit more just, you know, there's so much pressure. They don't quite have as many weird things as the personality quirks show them as they used to, but they still do a little bit. But yeah, Brian Miller was cut from the cloth of great eccentric baseball relievers.
Yeah, that's part of what was so enjoyable about those teams was not only were they good and did they win, of course, it's always such a thrill to see your team win it all, but the characters, I mean, and, you know, Tim Lincecum getting busted for having marijuana in his car, you know, like that honestly endeared him so much to the Bay Area, like more than anything else. So I look back on those teams very fondly, and at the same time, it's like I realize I was a bit spoiled as a baseball fan, and there are a lot of fans who never get to see their team win or haven't gotten to see their team win in decades. And so if the Giants don't win another World Series in my lifetime, I can't honestly complain.
Yeah. I mean, as a Mets fan, I completely fall in the other category. I mean, the less said, the better. I mean, we've had such a roller coaster ride as Mets fans. Just, you know, with the last, like, 2 years ago, Scherzer, DeGrom. Oh my God, you know. And then where did that go? I knew it. I knew when they both went to the Rangers. I knew the Rangers were going to win the World Series, even though DeGrom was hurt. I said, this is it. This is his World Series. And I mean, just the minute they traded Scherzer to the Rangers, I was like, they are going to win the World Series. And, you know, that might have been Mets fan fatalism, but I was right. Yeah. But it's, you know, the great thing about baseball is that it is the only sport that mirrors the seasons, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, it's spring training. You're starting out fresh and, you know, that hope rises and the dog days of summer and you're grinding and then the struggle in the fall of the World Series. It's, and, you know, and then the hot stove league of the winter when you rest and then it begins all anew. I mean, there's something so primal about that to me that makes it just, I don't know, it speaks to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I spent all winter looking forward to sitting outside, you know, in the sunshine. The temperature has crept above 60 degrees and I'm listening to a fantasy baseball podcast. And like this is the stuff that dreams are made of, honestly. And here we are. We've entered that era. So it's great.
It is. Well, that's fantastic. Well, Jonah, congrats on Out of Left Field coming out. It's on sale now, I believe. You'll be doing a signing.
It's publishing on March 26th. I'm not 100% sure when this podcast will come out, but March 26th is pub day. There is a launch event at Blue Stockings on the Lower East Side that evening. So definitely come to that if you're in the New York City area. And I'll be doing a bunch more events after that, including a lot in California. So if you are in the Bay Area or LA, check out my website. JonahNewmanComics.com has all the events and would love to see you there.
Awesome. All right. Well, Jonah, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story with us. It's really been great to have you.
Thank you, Heidi. It's been such a privilege. Great to talk to you and hope to see you at Mocha and other events.
Yeah. Soon. Yes, definitely. And as always, there will be more to come.
Did you see that there was like a Renegade table outside?
I did. So those guys are friends with, there's a gentleman in San Francisco named Floyd who does like just the most indie comics you can imagine. And he walks around San Francisco with like the most disgusting folding table you've ever seen and a tiny shopping cart full of comics. And then he's bouncing around between San Francisco and New York. So those guys started publishing under Floyd, who literally scans all of his comics at the Silver Sprocket shop.
And, like, I see. You have a relationship.
Yeah, he comes in, talks their ear off about everything and is so knowledgeable about everything comics. Really good dude with just so much energy and passion. And I saw it, I'm like, oh, this is some Floyd level. Oh, yep, those are Floyd's comics.
That's funny. So you were saying this is the first time you've been back since 2020, but it wasn't, you were basically indicating the first time you've been given table space.
Yeah, we've applied pretty consistently. Right. I think we're not as known within whatever the New York comic scene is, I guess. So we were really excited to be accepted this year, and it's been really cool.
So can you speak more about that? Like, what is the function then for you coming from San Francisco? Is it creating that, like, understanding or that brand awareness, so to speak, not to use those terms, but?
We've got a couple of goals. A lot of it is having FaceTime with our cartoonist. We had 8 different artists out here doing signings, and we have, you know, a lot of artists from New York that we publish. So we want to show up to engage and hang out and have better conversations than what, like, a Zoom check-in can really allow for. And it's also just showing up and being present in the comic community. New York has been a really good city for us for shows. Like, Comics Art Brooklyn was really good for us. I think Mocha is kind of the only event of this size for the kind of comics that we do that's going on over here. I'm not sure if, like, a New York Comic Con Read Pop thing is really for us. If they won't let us be in Artist Alley and want us to spend $4,000 for, like, a booth next to, like, an energy drink company, it's just not really for us.
And you said you have 8 artists signing. You brought a lot of your crew out, too, right? You have a lot of staff here?
So our remote publishing crew, our production designer, Karina, our admin, Joan, and our publicist, Kyle, who just got hired by Abrams. So
oh, really?
our former, as of next week, publicist Kyle is all based out of here in New York. But then also cartoonists that we've been working with for a really long time. Alex Crocus, Rosemary Blair O'Connell, Kimberly Wang, Robin Chapman. I'm just looking at the table to see what's not.
Yeah, they're all here in New York.
Yeah, they're all right here in New York. So it, like, I feel like it'd be a bummer if they had their big local comic show and their publisher wasn't out here, like, celebrating their work.
What's the show been like? Like, do you have any overall impressions about what you're seeing or trends that are emerging?
Yeah, I didn't really know what to expect. In the past, like, this has been, like, a cool show. Like, we've broken even, but not really, like, we've been real scrappy staying on our friends' couches. We're still staying on our friends' couches. But we did really well. Like, we sold out of, like, two-thirds or more of what we brought in the first day alone. I think part of that is that the production value of our books has really leveled up since we've last been here. And the books are just so good. And people know who Rosemary is and all these other... Like, we sold out of Rosemary's books on the first day.
Oh, yeah. I had a question about that, what you sold out of. I think I took a note earlier. Okay, well, that's so helpful. Thank you.
But yeah, it's going really good. It's always interesting. I keep spreadsheets of what our sales are at all the events, and I never know exactly what to compare it to. Like, is this like a San Diego Comic-Con show or a small press expo show? And it's not like any of them. It's so, yeah, figuring out the calculus and the alchemy is wild.
Thank you. Okay, this is Meg Lemke from 4PW's More to Come podcast. I'm here at the Mocha Fest in New York, and I'm talking to Evan Dom. Is that how you pronounce your name, Evan?
Yes, that is it.
And Evan has a new book coming out with Iron Circus called The Delivery.
The Last Delivery.
The Last Delivery, thank you. You're not showing that at Mocha today.
Yeah, it occurred to me after I left that I could have brought my, like, advanced copy for people to see. But no, it's not out for a couple months. There's some, I think June, I think it's supposed to be out. But I'm really happy with it. I mean, I really, like, took the coloring seriously and tried to get it to reproduce exactly how I wanted it, and it's beautiful to see it line up, you know. It's exciting.
What are you featuring at the show? Vatu?
Yeah, I mean, I have the four books of my self-published fantasy graphic novel, Vatu. And I have some copies of my illustrated Wizard of Oz and Island Book, one of my books with first, second books. Honestly, nothing really terribly new or exciting. I feel like I am not totally well prepared for this show, but.
Well, despite your preparedness level, how is it going?
It's going great. This is also I started teaching at SBA under a year ago, so this is my first Mocha where, like, students are coming up to me and I'm seeing all these people I know from school. That's been very nice. And I don't know, it always seems like a pretty enthusiastic crowd.
That's powerful, right? To see your students come up and for them to see you with your wares out, right? Like, a different relationship.
Yeah. It's, I'm still adjusting with how to do that, how to be in that role. But it's, you know, I'm learning a lot. It's a fun job.
What was it like working with Iron Circus?
I have loved it. I did, The Harrowing of Hell with them a couple years ago, too. Iron Circus is chiefly Spike, who is the person who I have known probably one of the people I've known the longest in comics. And, like, it was fun to, it's exciting to see her, build this infrastructure. And then I was in this position with both of these books, Harrowing of Hell and Last Delivery, where, like, I really know her aesthetic. And, like, I have an idea for a book, and I'm like, oh, I know who would like this. And, I don't know, it's fun. It's a very, like, I don't know, human, personal relationship to have to a publisher, I think.
Have you seen anything at this show? Like, have you gotten out of the booth at all and seen anything you liked?
I haven't gotten out that much. I was looking at, I think I'm going to get a book of Josh Bayer, Bayer, just wild, scratchy artwork. I'm going to buy one of those.
It's probably Unended, right?
One of them. He's got, like, several things on the table.
Oh, that's his newest book.
Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're a professional. Of course you know.
Except I got your title slightly wrong, so.
I just like the aesthetic of his work really a lot.
He really fills the page.
Yeah, he really fills the page.
Anything else you want to say about Mocha or the new book coming out?
I don't know. It's nice to be here. I'm very excited about the book. I think it is, in some ways, a weird new direction for me. Mm-hmm. It was very much a, like, COVID lockdown fugue project for me. I'm excited for people to see it, finally.
Thank you so much. And that was Evan Dahm here at Mocha Fest.